the general topic, I've been talking on essentially Christianity and social reform. If you have the syllabus, you can see some of the things we've covered. There's a sort of common theme, I suppose, in Christianity and social reform, although the individual have to feel that that you can't participate if you might not have heard what came before.
The choir is just coming.
Oh, okay.
Rosemary, yeah. Over here on the level.
This is also, of course, a kind of book list for people who want to read in this area. It gives you a lot, or not a lot, but some kind of key books. Well, this week is sort of down here, July 22nd, obviously. Sometimes you kind of lose track of what day it is around here. Today, before this time, I've been talking more about past historical movements, whereas this week we're kind of getting up to the 20th century with a variety of contemporary movements. Today we're going to talk about Camus, the whole concept of some Christian hope or destiny of mankind at the goal of history is entirely repudiated. So it's the rebel without hope. And then we'll be, Wednesday we'll be talking about the secular theologians and so on, this whole concept of secularity and how contemporary theologians are trying to deal with that. And Friday, new Christian Marxist dialogue. So these are all contemporary movements. And then the following week, if you're here, we'll also be hitting other
Fine.
Now, just to give a little background, the 19th century saw a kind of secularization of the Christian doctrine of the kingdom of God, that history is moving towards some great destiny, some great kingdom of the future. In the 19th century, this idea appeared in what we might call a secular form. That is, it was believed that history was moving toward some progressive evolution to some perfect state as the goal of history. But this was no longer identified with Christ or the church or something, but it was identified with secular social movements. And this idea of progress, evolutionary optimism, and so on, ran all through both the philosophic and the social movements of the 19th century. You think of Hegel, has a whole philosophy of the movement of history. In many ways, Teilhard de Chardin, whose publications are just recently released, but actually was a man who was formed by Bergson and by 19th century philosophy, carries on the same idea of some evolutionary progress in history. The social movements, Christian socialism, secular socialism, and then particularly Marxism, translated into secular form, this idea of some movement in history aiming at some perfect state of the future. Now, the First World War was a kind of revolt and rejection of this this kind of evolutionary optimism. It was an attack on the progressivism of the liberal tradition. This progressivism is often what's called liberalism. Liberalism in the 19th century philosophical and social sense. The First World War was a kind of catastrophic experience that resulted in a rejection of a lot of this kind of naive, or perhaps not naive, but anyway, rejection of this kind of liberalism and progressivism. In theology, this developed what we call crisis theology, which rejected some kind of history through man's imminent progress and instead located God in some transcendent sphere above history, where he continually, as it were, breaks in, knocks apart man's idolatries, and opens man up to a new freedom. So there's a kind of a crisis that operates this way rather than a movement through history. Now, the Second World War really was an even more cataclysmic experience. The whole revelation of the demonism of modern civilization, the death camps, practically shattered everything that was left of Western optimism, at least it appeared at that time, the whole experience of the Second World War. Seemed to leave almost nothing standing of traditional Western faith. It seemed as though all of Western man's works had sort of opened up and revealed nothing but chaos, kind of like an abyss filled with devils and so on. All of the foundations of Western faith seem to crumble through the experience of the Second World War. Those who lived through this experience, and this was typical of the French intellectuals like Camus and Sartre and so on, the people who lived through this experience, who belonged to the French resistance, who lived through the Nazi regime as underground fighters and so on, they found it very difficult to salvage any values upon which they could stand. And so this is the context in which you have to understand Camus. He was a resistance fighter. He was himself a French Algerian, actually a French man, but born in Algeria rather than made in Algeria. And he was very much a part of the resistance, and he, more than anyone else, perhaps expresses the mood of the resistance. Now, Camus was one of these many faceted people. He's hard to locate. You know, is he a philosopher? Is he a literary man? Is he a poet? And so on. He's one of these people, who, like Sartre, too, who breaks down the categories. He's sort of all these things he wrote. He's a philosopher in novels and a novel writer in philosophy and so on. I'll be talking today not about his literature, however, but about what you might call his more strict philosophical work. Now, Camus' first effort to develop an experimental principle by which to gain some value, to wrest some little bit of value out of this world that seemed to be rushing toward destruction, his first effort to develop some kind of principle by which man could rescue some value out of this chaotic world. This experimental principle he called the absurd, the idea of the absurd, which may seem like a kind of nihilistic principle, but it was his first effort to gain what he felt was some little island of positive value upon which man could stand in this situation. Now, he developed the idea of the absurd, particularly in a book called The Myth of Sisyphus, which came out in 1942, as you see, right in the middle of the Second World War. And in The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus explores the possibility of suicide in the face of the absurdity of human life. Life has lost all coherence. Man can gain no kind of overarching system of values out of it. Is it possible that in the face of the absurdity of human life, man should simply commit suicide? But as Camus explored the idea of suicide, he recognized or brought to the surface the fact that suicide itself was a protest. Suicide, in effect, was man's revolt against the incoherence of the world. The world is incoherent, but there is something in man that protests this incoherence. So suicide even the movement towards suicide is an insistence on value, a protest against meaninglessness. The absurd, he said, is born of the contradiction between human expectation, in other words, man demanding meaning, man demanding value, this contradiction between human expectation, human demand for meaning, and the absurd condition of the world. Now, the question which he tried to pose whether this incoherent condition of the world renders human existence itself untenable, in other words, whether we should respond to this by suicide. Now, Camus insists that we must face and take upon ourselves the burden of this dilemma of the absurd. If we simply believe in God or believe in some transcendent life beyond death, this is an escape. This is a way of avoiding the reality of the dilemma. In other words, God and the afterlife are sort of quixotic efforts to resolve the problem of evil, but they don't really resolve it at all. They are simply escapes from it, sort of dream escapes from it. We must face here and now the reality of this dilemma. But suicide is also a way of evading the absurd. In the contradiction between man's own demand for coherence and the insufficiency of reality, man finds that he is in fact affirming a value which is inherent in his own nature. And when man discovers his own nature as having some value, some meaning, but he finds that the world does not confirm this value. In other words, there is a lack of rapport, you might say, between his being, his nature, which demands meaning, and the world outside, which does not confirm this demand for meaning. And to that extent, man is a stranger in the world. This is the idea he explores in the novel, The Stranger. Man is a stranger in the world. He is an alien, demanding meaning, which is inherent in his own nature, and yet not being satisfied in this demand by the world. Now, to live, therefore, is to take upon ourselves the burden of affirming this dignity of human life in this kind of world, which remains cold and unresponsive to man's demand for meaning. We must affirm human dignity in a world without God or without any transcendent principle which will uphold and answer this demand. So this is a very stark kind of humanism. Sort of out of our own bootstraps, out of our own demand for meaning, we must uphold meaning in a world which is unresponsive to us. The myth of Sisyphus is really the myth of Sisyphus in ancient Greek legend is the man who rolls a stone up a mountain in hell. He's a man down in Hades, condemned ever to roll a great stone up the hill, pushing toward a goal, you see, and just as he gets to the top of the hill, the stone always rolls back down. And he has to go back and start again. And what Camus is saying is that this is the model of our human life. We are in hell. We never achieve the goal. Our whole life is just pushing that rock up the hill only to have it slide back again. But this in itself is where we must find meaning, in this effort of human life to achieve meaning, even though the reality never in fact confirms it. So this is a very, you know, frightening kind of lonely humanism, which he develops in the idea of the absurd. Now this idea of the absurd, he then develops in a fuller form. You might say it finds its mature form in his concept of rebellion, which is really probably the way we should understand the word, the rebel. His philosophy of revolt or rebellion, as it were, is the mature development of this principle, which he begins to explore in the idea of the absurd. in the investigation of the rebel, or the whole phenomenon of man and revolt, this question of the value of individual life, you know, what is the value of my individual life, this question is enlarged to include the question of the human community, in other words, it's enlarged to a communal perspective. In other words, the question of the value of the individual life is enlarged to include the question of all life. All life, which is necessarily included whenever we speak of the value of any individual life. We cannot affirm any individual life without immediately, as it were, including and basing our affirmation on some affirmation of the value of mankind in general. Therefore, in Man in Revolt, or The Rebel, what Camus says is that when we reject suicide, we must immediately see that this implies the rejection of murder as well. The affirmation of the life of the brother, the life of the neighbor, must be included in the affirmation of the self. Now, Camus started to explore this, of course, right after the Myth of Sisyphus, and in 1945 he published an essay called Remarks on Revolt, which really contained the core of his idea. And in that article he said the following, which I think really contains the core of his idea of revolt. Here at last we have the first bit of progress that the spirit of revolt brings to bear on reflection, which was first penetrated with absurdity and the apparent sterility of the world. In the absurd experience, the tragedy is individual, but with the movement of revolt, it becomes conscious of being collective. It is the adventure of all. The first progress of a mind struck by this estrangement is to recognize that he shares this estranged condition with all mankind. So this is sort of the core of it. We're moving out to an affirmation of the value of mankind or human nature as such. Now this idea then, as I said, was developed in the book, The Rebel. In the first chapter of this book, Camus tries to lay out the groundwork for this theme, showing how the movement of man as he revolts against something, the movement of man as he revolts or protests against something, whatever it may be, this implicitly is an affirmation of the human dignity of all mankind. Not mankind in the abstract, not just universal mankind in some sort of theoretical way, but an affirmation of all living human beings. In other words, when the oppressed person, the slave, or in whatever form he may take, maybe the child even, against the parent, when the oppressed person, the person who's been formed, as it were, in the image of someone else, when the oppressed person rises up against the oppressor, this is a value judgment. It is a declaration that there is a limit to one's toleration of debasement, that there are values in the self which must be respected. The rebel is saying to the oppressor, you have gone too far. There is a limit. I have something that I must affirm. You have gone too far, and this is the beginning of revolt. So the slave begins his revolt by declaring a value in himself, which must not be transgressed. There is a limit to what he will tolerate. But now I have something that I must affirm. I cannot let you go any farther. You see, as long as the man is oppressed, he really, as it were, accepts the value judgment of the oppressor, that he is simply an object to be used. And this is why you get a very limited humanity in people who are oppressed. They have accepted the value judgment of the oppressor, that they are not really human beings. See, every form of discrimination, every form of prejudice, every form of oppression is really a way of saying, this is just an object, it's not a human being like me. In other words, every form of prejudice and oppression is an implicit or explicit denial of the full humanity of that which you oppress. You turn it into an object. This is why oppressors always develop some idea that the oppressed group is not fully human. We can see that all through the Middle Ages, that was developed rather in an advanced form, the idea that women are not fully human. They have they do not really have a rational mind, which is the way we define humanity was defined. Humanity was defined as man as the rational animal, and women lacking this are quite simply not really fully human. They are rather secondary beings. The same way we discuss the Negro. The Negro isn't really fully human, and so on. He's an animal, he doesn't, so on. So all oppression is really a denial of humanity as a rationale for oppression. And the rebel, in effect, is always an affirmation of humanity, a standing up and an insistence on one's own humanity. Revolt, therefore, is the awakening to self-consciousness in the oppressed. You see, oppression really tries to impose this other self-image on the oppressed. So the oppressor accepts that self-image and does not really think for himself. Whereas the revolt, which stands up and says, you must help me as a man, the revolt is always an awakening to self-consciousness. This, by the way, is I'm sure why in the riots in our city, you do not find riots in the most oppressed part of the city. In other words, the really poorest, really the most sunk in lethargy. That's not where the riots occur. The riots occur in places where there is a self-consciousness, where the people are coming alive, where there is community organizations working. And that's why the poor city fathers are always saying, but we were doing so well in this area. There were all kinds of things happening. Yes, indeed, and that's precisely why that became the area of self-consciousness, because people were waking up in that area. So, revolt is always, and by the way, in the ghetto, this is my interest to know, these are never referred to as riots. That's a white man's word. That's a riot. In the black ghetto, these are always referred to as the revolt. And as soon as you call that thing a riot, you immediately are recognized as a white person imposing your white consciousness, whereas in the ghetto itself, the riot is always what we call a riot, is always referred to as the revolt. So those are just some illustrations. But what the main point here is that revolt is affirmation of humanity, and when this occurs, it always signals an awakening to self-awareness. So revolt corresponds with the birth in the slave of a sense of his own personhood. And once this value is grasped by the slave, it tends to become an all-absorbing value. You might say almost paradoxically, it becomes more valuable than himself. Once he grasps this value of personhood, it becomes something for which he is willing to die. Now this as it were, universalizing of the value of revolt, the value of personhood that is discovered here, suggests immediately that it is not just a value that is subjectively conceived. You know, there's not just my personal affirmation, but it's an affirmation of a value of humanity, a value inherent in human nature as such. So this is the ground on which Camus develops his concept of human nature, that man has a nature. Here he perhaps departs from the existentialist that says that there is no such thing as essence, but only man's apprehension of things. Camus insists that there is a human nature, a universal human nature that exists, and revolt is the way in which man becomes aware of this human nature. Now, as I said, revolt is an awakening to self-awareness, awakening to one's own personhood, and this means that it is also a breaking of silence. You see, in the relationship of master-slave, oppressor and oppressed, the oppressed is silent. He does not talk back. You see, he does not communicate how this experience is affecting him. He never talks back to the oppressor. And so the oppressor gets no reflection of himself in the oppressed. He only sees his own reflection in the oppressed. You project your image upon the slave, and that's what he is. And you never suddenly see your own face reflected in that man and discover how you look to him. So when the man revolts, that's the breaking of silence, the opening up to communication between the oppressed and the oppressor, when suddenly the oppressed stands up and begins to tell the oppressor what he looks like to him. And then this is, of course, what is creating such a kind of psychic explosion in modern America, that the black man has been silent, to use again the illustration of American Negro, the black man has been silent. He has, to some extent, accepted the judgment of the white man upon him, and to the extent that he has not accepted it, he has talked about it only in his own community. Suddenly, the silence is breaking. The black man is telling the white man how he looks to him, and the result is very shocking. The black man is saying, "You are a white devil," and so forth. This is the way I experience you. I think perhaps one of the best movies I ever saw for this was a movie called Nothing But a Man. Has any of you seen that? Nothing But a Man? Well, I think the value of this movie is that it allows the audience to get inside the black experience itself and see how the white world looks to a black person. And this is a part of the breaking of silence. And there's a scene in there where the Negro man and his girlfriend are talking, parked in a car and talking, and suddenly a couple of white thugs come around. Now, you know, just ordinary, perhaps I shouldn't use the word thugs, they're just ordinary white youths, joyriding along the road. They see this couple and they get out and they start to intimidate them. And of course, they have tremendous power. These people are in Southern society, there's very little that they can do in this situation. They begin to intimidate him, to suggest that they're going to rape the girl and so forth. And they play with this couple in the car, teasing them, and then finally they go away. And you feel this terrible fright of this helpless black people in the white society, teased, not knowing what's going to happen, and then finally left like a mouse that's been played with or then abandoned. And the remark of the Negro man to his girlfriend is this tremendous sense of relief that he says to her, "They just ain't hardly human, are they?" See, now this is a shocking kind of thing, because aren't we the standard of humanity? You know, I mean, if the Negro wants to rise up, he has to come into our white schools. Integration is the way to become human. We are the standard of humanity. And then suddenly to reverse this image and see how you look from the other side, that from the other side, you may look not hardly even human. This is a very shocking thing. So revolt is the beginning of dialogue, the beginning of communication, the sudden talking back, where the oppressor suddenly tells you how you look to him. And if you can sustain this dialogue, if you don't just fall apart and start killing each other, if you can manage to keep this dialogue going, that is the beginning of community, beginning of real community for the first time. So these are the kind of values that Sartre finds in revolt. He also insists that the man in revolt cannot negate the humanity of the oppressor. That even though he may experience the oppressor as a dehumanizing force, which is what oppression means. He experiences the oppressor as a dehumanizing force toward him. Ultimately, he cannot negate or deny the humanity of the oppressor, because if he does so, he would be impugning the very ground on which he himself stands. In other words, he is declaring his revolt in the name of humanity. And therefore, ultimately, he must raise his perspective to the level where he would even include the oppressor in this common humanity. See, so ultimately, this must be an affirmation of all mankind. And even the oppressed one must ultimately recognize the humanity of the oppressor as the ground on which he himself affirms his own value. In other words, there's no way of affirming your humanity and killing your brother. To kill one man impugns the humanity of all. As Camus puts it, if men have no commonality to which they can refer, in other words, if there's not a universal human nature which encompasses us all, if men have no commonality to which they can refer, then man is incomprehensible to man. And this, of course, is the danger in some of the black power talk, is that there's a tendency to assume that there is somehow a black human nature which white people can never share, and to sort of universalize this experience of difference and neglect to raise this discussion up to the level which affirms the dignity of all men, and which is the basis on which any man or group must affirm his own dignity. So that's a sort of groundwork for a humanism based on the experience of protest, you might say, the experience of revolt. Now, Camus then goes on to explore revolt as it has occurred in philosophy and literature and in history, and to show why these revolts have not raised up this true humanism that should lie in revolt, but rather has developed in a nihilistic and destructive fashion. And he finds this the key to this in several causes, but most specifically in this tendency of the man who revolts to deny the humanity of that which he revolts again, and therefore ultimately to undermine the groundwork on which he himself stands, and the result is complete nihilism. Nihilism is the loss of all values altogether. Now, I'm not going to go into too much in his analysis of this, because that would be a very complicated discussion, and you can read that in the book itself. First of all, he talks about metaphysical revolt. And I'll just briefly tell you what that is. Metaphysical revolt is essentially this protest against the unjust universe. The universe is seen as lacking coherence, lacking justice. It doesn't come out into the system of meaning that man demands. And therefore, man revolts against an absurd universe, and this includes the author of the universe. In other words, there's no way for God to escape from the world that he's made. If that's the way the world is, then that's the kind of God that rules the world. So the revolt against the universe becomes a revolt against God. But it is a revolt against God in the name of order and meaning. Which man demands meaning, he demands order, he demands coherence, and in the name of that value, he revolts against a universe and a God of a universe who does not sustain this demand for meaning. In the name of justice, he denounces an unjust creator. He, as it were, stands in judgment upon God. He stands in judgment upon the author of such a universe in which evil, catastrophe, and senseless slaughter can happen. He stands in judgment upon a universe in which little children are slaughtered and so on. And then, and he goes on to talk about various forms of metaphysical rebellion, the Marquis de Sade, from which we get the word sadism, and that's, he's essentially kind of a philosopher of sadism in a way, although much more complicated perhaps than our word. Also the figure of Ivan in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, who was also always a very important figure for the literary philosopher. And then finally Nietzsche, all of these as metaphysical rebels who denounce God in the name of justice. And he shows how these metaphysical rebellions have ended in a kind of nihilism. Then after his discussion of metaphysical revolt, he goes on to discuss historical movements of revolt. As this revolt against the universe begins to pass into programs of social action for rebellion, into the actual movements of revolutionaries in the 19th and 20th centuries. And he shows how the revolt against God becomes then in turn a revolt against principles and finally ends in a kind of revolutionary action which has lost all working standards of value. The way he analyzes this movement toward nihilism in historical rebellions is basically this. He starts out with the French Revolution. And he shows how the killing of the king was a kind of killing of God, because the king in the secularized concept of the king that came down from the 16th century, you might say when Europe revolted against the church as the representative of God on earth, when they revolted against the Pope and the Bishop as the representatives of God on earth, as God's vicar on earth, it was the king and the prince who stepped into the shoes of the Pope and the Bishop. So then you got the from even late Middle Ages on down into the 18th century, a concept of kingship by divine right. It is the king who rules by divine right. He is God's representative on earth. And the French Revolution, then, in dethroning the king, in guillotining the king, was overturning the throne of God, overturning the throne of God's representative on earth. So he says that the French Revolution, in effect, sort of acted out this metaphysical rebellion, it acted out the dethroning of God. But even though it dethroned God, it did not dethrone the idea of transcendent principles. It believed in justice and right, liberty, fraternity, equality, and so on. There were these divine principles, as Camus says in one place. They overthrew God, but they sent back the transcendent principles for which God had stood like balloons into an empty sky. No more God up there to affirm them, that these transcendent principles were sent back like balloons to inhabit an empty sky, a sky in which there was no longer any God. And this was the groundwork on which the French Revolution stood, an overturning of God's vicar on earth, but an insistence, or in the name of these transcendent principles, of liberty, equality, fraternity, and so on. Then Camus sees a second movement in the 19th century which dethrones the transcendent principles themselves. And he sees the author of this movement to be Hegel, or at least Hegel summarizes and gathers up this movement. What Hegel did, in effect, was to take the transcendent principles that existed in heaven, bring them down to earth, and sort of throw them into the historical process itself. So the transcendent principles of freedom and justice and liberty and so on no longer exist sort of up there as standards by which we may be judged, but they exist at the end of history as the goal of history. I'll draw you a little picture if I can. Let's say here's mankind, and here's the transcendent. And in the old view of history, this transcendent was eternal, and therefore it coexisted with every moment in history. Every moment in history was equally available to the transcendent. So wherever you were, whether you were in the first century or the 20th century, there was always these eternal principles which were available to you, judging you at every moment, wherever you may be. Now what Hegel did was to dethrone the transcendent principles from the sky and put them as the goal of a historical process. Now this means that liberty, equality, fraternity will come out in the end. You might say that it all comes out in the wash. These values will come out in the end, but they come out through a revolutionary process in which there are no longer any eternal principles by which the process itself may be judged. In other words, the transcendent is the goal of history, but there is no transcendent principles existent here and now by which the means to that goal may be judged. So this, in effect, creates a situation in which any means to the goal are acceptable. Murder, lies, conspiracies, any kind of bestiality, oppression, death camps, wholesale murder of the kulaks, anything that will get to the goal is justifiable, because there are no principles by which you judge the means. The principles only come out at the end of a historical process. So this this point of view, Camus feels, is the key to the tragedy of Marxism, that Marxism is based upon this historical dialectic. And therefore it creates a kind of paradox in which the goals are these eternal ideals which man has always held, this classless society where man will be truly free, truly authentic, and so on. This is the goal of the Marxist dialectic. But any kind of oppression and murder and so on is legitimate as the way of getting to that goal. Furthermore, the process, because the goal is never achieved, the process finally becomes institutionalized and, as it were, infinitely prolonged. The kingdom never comes, but the church comes, or the party comes, the Communist Party. And the party, the Revolutionary Party, becomes institutionalized with a sort of indefinite mandate to continue the revolution until the kingdom comes. So you have a revolutionary party sort of institutionalized, infinitely prolonged, capable of using any kind of murder and torture and so on in the name of that salvation to which they are pointing, but which never comes. So this sort of dialectic, this immanentism, you might say, Camus sees as the philosophical Achilles heel of Marxism, from which it derived from Hegel, and creates the tragedy of a party devoted to freedom but using slavery as its method of getting to freedom. And this critique of Marxism, by the way, which is a good deal more subtle than what I presented here, this critique of Marxism was very shocking to the French Marxists, because Camus had been sort of identified with the radical wing, the Marxists, and so on, and for him to come out and criticize Marxism in this way was, you know, very shocking at that time. Then finally, I'll just finish up by by showing how Camus tries to rescue a positive principle out of this history. What Camus says, in effect, is that we have to forget the absolute future and concentrate upon the now. That the now is all we have. We do not have an absolute in the future. And we must get over this madness, which is he sees as Judeo-Christian madness, a willing to sacrifice man here and now for the sake of some absolute future to come. We must give up this madness that would sacrifice man here and now for some absolute salvation to come. We must concentrate on the one thing we really have, which is the present. As John Cooper put it the other day, the Christianity and Marxism is pessimistic as to man, but optimistic as to human destiny. It sees man as perverted, depraved, fallen, but it is optimistic as to his ultimate salvation. Camus says we must reverse this. We must be pessimistic or agnostic as to human destiny. We don't know what the human destiny will be. It may be the whole world would just die out like a cinder. We must be modestly agnostic, perhaps not pessimistic, but modestly agnostic as to human destiny, but optimistic as to man. We must affirm man here and now and give up the madness that would sacrifice the only value we really have for some absolute future which never comes. He links this up with the classical spirit, the spirit of moderation, the spirit of balance, the spirit that insists that we are men and not gods, as opposed to what he sees as the a spirit which affirms nature, as opposed to the Christian, and in a secular form, the Marxist spirit, that affirms history, that insists on an absolute, and that would sacrifice man here and now for the sake of this absolute. So Camus' principle that he emerges out of the rebel is this very kind of modest, moderate principle that we do not know what the end of history will be. We do not know what the outcome of the human game will be. We are agnostic about that. We only have a little light of our own experience here and now, which only lights up perhaps the next step or two that we're going to take. And this is all we have, and this is where we must live. Sometimes it's almost, you know, like this Christadelphian slogan that says it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness, or perhaps to put it another way, it's better to light one candle by which you can walk modestly than to blow up the world seeking for some absolute value. Yeah?
In some sense, though, this is hope.
I'm
puzzled by why you emphasize rebel without hope.
Well, without this absolute, you might say, absolute hope, with a kind of modest hope built upon the principles that we can grasp here and now, but with an agnostic view as to the total framework.
Hope which is not a belief in anything certain, but which is just plain hopes.
Yeah, a kind of faith in a way that's perhaps closer to the idea of faith walking in uncertainty. I mean, the other kind of dogmatism really, in a way, does eliminate faith. Because it imposes a kind of assumption or presumption of certainty. We don't have any doubt. We know what the answer is going to be. It's all in the Bible. It's all in Marx, and we know what the whole dialectic is going to be and what's going to look like. You see this kind of presumption that you know. Whereas he says, no, we don't know what the ultimate framework is, but we walk in a kind of faith.
The burden is entirely on me.
Yeah.
I was wondering how you would relate this to, you know, in the beginning when you were talking about the apocalyptic, idea and the tune in, drop out, and which one you'd sort of hang this one, or is it kind of both?
Well, I think it's really closer, without the dropout sign of it, closer to to the traditional sort of contemplative principles that insist that there's some values present at every moment to which man must relate, something like that.
But man has constituted these himself, so in a sense he's...
Well, without having a certain sense of God to affirm it, you know, a creator that affirms this nature, Camus does insist that man has a nature. It's not just something that he kind of arbitrarily plucks out, although in a certain sense he makes it through his self-awareness. He becomes aware of it, but he becomes aware of something that's there. This is where he kind of departs from the existentialist thing. He insists that there is an abiding human nature which man doesn't just create out of nothing, but which is there. He discovers it through revolt. And he can't explain how it got there in a certain sense. He doesn't have the creator to explain how it got there, but he insists that it's there by the very action of revolt that you discover it. You know, that when you go and bump into a tree, it's the first time you became aware of it. But, you know, it was there, you didn't create it out of your imagination and then bump into it. So he does have this insistence, you might say, in human nature as a universal good there.
Does he draw out in any of his writings what that human nature is?
It's really basically these kind of values of a commonality of humanity, an insistence upon respect for the other as the condition on which you will be respected.
Yeah, but commonality of humanity doesn't say anything about what the humanity is.
Well, I mean, one could then put, you know, various words, justice and love and so on, all of which he would put into this picture. But it comes out through experience. One would continually create, I suppose, new and different words to express this many-sided reality. I mean, he practically doesn't define it in that sense, except out of this experience of affirming, you know, that I am. And since I know that I am, I must affirm that you are, that we all are, that to kill you, to deny that you are, is really to deny that I am. So the essence of it is really this I am. He even sort of translates the Cartesian cogito, which is, I think, therefore I am. And he translates that to the existential dimension to say, I revolt, therefore we are, is the formula that he uses. I revolt, therefore we are, we exist.
But in The Stranger, isn't this self-affirmation sort of very scant, you know, there's hardly anything but simply some feelings, likes and dislikes. It seems to be sort of a poverty in respect of humanity that he discovers in himself.
Yeah, well, I think this is where Camus always starts. You know, he insists that we don't have this big picture. That's not where we really are. You know, we don't have these great absolutes. We start always in this very sort of poverty-stricken and modest way by some very tenuous movements to exist, to discover that, you know, that we are. And then this sense, you see, of an alien surrounding, almost like a Kafka surround, of incoherence that flows around the stranger, and then really in the end comes out quixotically, as though he doesn't, he murders somebody, and it ends in a kind of uncertainty of what these movements are to mean. And I think that's typical of the way Camus begins. With this said, I think perhaps the stranger is the beginning of the exploration, but always with this very sense of that these movements are always very modest and tenuous.
Might not the stranger be perhaps a picture in the negative, showing the extreme poverty, really, and evoking in the reader the values that he wants.
Yeah, I think so, because in the end he isn't able to, I said, make anything clear out of this. And he ends as a murderer, yet sort of quixotically affirming some values.
Does this philosophy have anything to say to the humanistic philosophy of today?
It is a really radical humanism without God and without heaven, without these sort of transcendent poles by which you can refer yourself as the source and the goal. We don't know the source, we don't know the goal. We live in this agnostic framework in which all we know that we are, and that we are in this interdependence with each other. We protest against incoherence of the universe, which doesn't satisfy our demands for meaning, and yet this demand for meaning itself is the basis on which we stand. And that, in this kind of modest framework, we must serve to extend the light by whatever little bit we can, and push back the darkness by whatever little bit we can. And that's the sort of picture that you get out in the end. I would say Camus at his most optimistic, really, because The Stranger is where I think perhaps he's more on the absurdist line, where he's still where he's exploring this alienation between man and the world. But at his most optimistic, it's really that push back the barriers of darkness by whatever little bit you have. It's better to save one child's life than to draw fantastic schemes for saving the world and murder millions of people in the process. It's on that basis that he gave a famous address to some Christian monks, in which he said that, you have God and we don't, and yet we have this common humanity on which we must work to extend by whatever little bit the good that exists in the world. And if we can't appeal to you Christians as co-workers in this endeavor, who else can we turn to? It's a very beautiful essay.
You speak of this alienation to the world. Is this the physical world, or what is the other? Where do the other people of the world fit into this?
Well, the other people are, one has this value in oneself and one affirms it in all humanity. So there's a kind of, you might say, a solidarity in this sense of humanity over against the somehow the cosmos, which does not affirm the value in man. The man, for example, and this is the obvious dilemma of problem of evil, man demands that somehow things should work out for justice. That the good should be rewarded and the evil punished, but in fact this doesn't happen. The world doesn't seem to work so that either this doesn't happen in the world as it is, and it doesn't really look as though the world is sort of moving to some state where this will happen. We really can't believe that somehow after death there'll be some other life in which all of this will happen. That sort of projection of the problem of evil beyond history is no longer tenable. So we simply must accept the fact that the world is unjust. It doesn't work out according to our principles of justice.
Well, the point I was trying to make is he is talking about the rebel here as an individual and yet as also in society, the revolt of society. But yet, when he talks about his absurdity of the world, of being in the world, is he talking about the world as manifested by his fellow man, or the world as manifested by physical space?
It's in a certain sense the physical world, the universe, and then somehow the whole destiny of mankind on this planet.
But is it the physical world affecting his fellow man? I don't see
how. It sort of moves into the social dimension, for example, the problem of evil, doesn't come out the way man demands it. And yet, so there's a kind of contradiction between man's demand for justice
and his own self.
And and society and so on, you see.
Is this really a self-revolt then, actually, from society, when you extend this individual to the society?
Yeah.
Which is right. Nausea.
What?
Which is nausea.
Nausea.
But this is right. Now, I think he doesn't distinguish between man as a human being in asserting this humanism and man as part of society. Against one, he is in rebellion. Against the other, he cannot be. And I think that is the problem.
Yeah, he projects this somehow as the cosmos and doesn't really explore too much.
It's very vague in an area that's quite important.
Yeah, the way that cosmos, you know, is also the world in the sense of the world of man, so which is certainly the other.
If he defines cosmos in such broad terms, it's almost like having a metaphysical entity that he struggles against.
Yeah,
he doesn't declare.
It comes very close to, in some ways, and here the New Left and so on does take up Camus, this very vague way of using the word the system.
Yeah.
You see, the system or the establishment, the prevailing order of things, however you may look at it, the prevailing order of things somehow doesn't satisfy man's demand for justice, but man feels this demand as his personal value, which he must somehow assert. And so, and I think you get, you know, that same kind of very indiscriminate, you might say, way of using the system or the order of things or the world or something like that.
Camus is just really trying to sort of pragmatically overcome the essential alienation of man from everything by saying that those of us that, you know, recognize that we're in the same circumstances better be together in this.
Yeah, I mean he starts out in this very individual way in the absurdist line of a sense of alienation from everything, and then gradually evolves a sense of
it's
human nature
pragmatic.
And so on. Yeah, I think
because
that's where you have to understand.
You and you're alienated from me, and we're both in projects which are essentially opposed to each other, but if our projects are going to work, we better get together because we're both somehow cognizant of our projects, and we both have similar goals, and so
yeah. The revolt, the act of revolt, I mean, he analyzes it in terms of the alienation of man and man,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, the oppressed and the oppressor and so on. And out of this, gradually sort of deduces, as it were, a principle that even this revolt itself is not possible, ultimately, except through an affirmation of the commonality of man.
Wow.
So on. I mean, he kind of, as it were, starts very, you know, this very tenuous beginnings of feelings, and then he tries to very modestly deduce a kind of principle on which.
It seems the problem is that the purpose of resistance and rebellion, the goal of it is freedom. And at what point do you have enough freedom to say that you've reached your goal?
Camus speaks of his philosophy as the philosophy of limit, and the limit is defined by the existence of the other person. As soon as your freedom demands killing the other person, that's your limit, so to speak.
But only
you deny the principles on which you stand. And then
only because then you're granting him the freedom to kill you. Purely pragmatic.
Well, pragmatic in its method, but not completely in its basis, because you must have, I think the idea which he develops here is that I cannot revolt except by saying we are, and as soon as I kill you, I deny the we are, and I undermine the principle on which I revolt.